What did a group of ordinary citizens find out when they managed to stop a huge gas pipeline from being built?
That is exactly what drew me to this story. On the one hand, coming into it, I knew there was a lot of confusion out there around natural gas. And just the fact that people don't know it's methane, it has climate impacts that aren't talked about enough. But the other reason I thought this story was worthy of a book and getting a wider hearing was that this is a very rare case of the little guys won against the big energy company. And everyone told them they were wasting their time early on, right? Everyone said, this is inevitable. You're going up against Dominion Energy, by far the most politically powerful corporation in Virginia, and one of our nation's biggest energy companies. If they want to do something, it's going to happen. And so people heard that over and over again, but they kept fighting anyway. And what they found was that they had more agency than they realized.
That's Jonathan Mingle. We spend the hour with him talking about his book, Gaslight, The Atlantic Coast Pipeline and the Fight for America's Energy Future. This is Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And please spread the word about Writer's Voice. Follow us on X, Instagram, and Facebook. Go to writersvoice.net to find out how. It was billed as the bridge fuel to a clean energy future, what the fossil fuel industry calls natural gas. Natural sounds so benign, but the reality is much darker. From the fracking site, through the pipeline, and into your home, fossil gas leaks methane and other poisons like a roof leak during a rainstorm. Per year, the amount may be as much as tens of millions of metric tons of methane, a potent greenhouse gas, spewing into the atmosphere. And it's not just about air pollution. You might have seen the viral video of a homeowner who was able to light the water in his kitchen faucet on fire because of the methane leaking from a nearby gas well. That kind of pollution was what a group of residents from rural communities was fighting against when they went up against a proposed pipeline and won. Picture this. You open your mailbox to find a letter from a major energy corporation announcing plans to build a pipeline through your land, whether you agree or not. This sets off a 6-year saga that reaches all the way to the Supreme Court. In his book, Gaslight, Jonathan Mingle tells the story of that 6-year fight against Dominion Energy's plans to build the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. On one side, a corporate Goliath armed with billions of dollars and political influence. On the other, a diverse army of Davids, from farmers to conservationists, united in their determination to protect their homes and the environment. Mingle says that at stake in that battle wasn't just the fate of those communities, but the very future of American energy. Will the public buy into the decades-long narrative that natural gas is a bridge fuel to a greener future? Or will we recognize it for what it is, a methane bomb threatening both local livelihoods and the planet's stability? Jonathan Mingle is a freelance writer and journalist. He reports on political, policy, and grassroots battles over gas infrastructure and its local and global climate consequences. Mingle has written about climate change impacts and solutions, air pollution and public health, energy and resource issues, and much more for a range of outlets that include the New York Review of Books, the New York Times, and Yale Environment 360. Gaslight is out from Island Press. Jonathan Mingle, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
So in Gaslight, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and the Fight for America's Energy Future, you tell the story of a six-year fight to stop the building of a fracked gas pipeline that goes through North Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia. First, let's talk about terms. I personally try not to use the term natural gas, and you don't like it either. Tell us why.
Well, that is a great place to start. And the reason why natural gas is probably not the best term to use to describe what we're talking about is, one place to start is that natural gas is mostly methane. And that is a fact that most Americans, surveys have shown, don't really know. And plenty of folks don't really associate natural gas with fossil fuels, even though it is a fossil fuel. So, you know, the term natural gas is kind of a holdover from another era, you know, from the 19th century when the first gas utilities made gas from coal and other feedstocks to light street lamps in fast-growing cities like Baltimore, New York, Philadelphia. And they needed a way to distinguish between the gas that they manufactured versus the gas that kind of seeped out of the ground when people were drilling for oil. And so they called it natural gas. But we're still laboring under the misconception that natural gas is somehow more environmentally benign than coal or oil. So that is one reason that a lot of folks are now calling it fossil gas or methane gas or just methane, since natural gas is more than 90% methane.
Well, fracked gas is the other term I guess we use in New York. There are some surveys, polling, that has shown that natural gas is supported by people. You know, consumers, when asked if you like natural gas, they think it's cleaner. When you tell them it's fracked gas, that support goes way down. So I'll try to remember to use fossil gas since you do use it. It's widely has been touted as a bridge fuel, although we hear less of that recently. Briefly, tell us, what is the environmental impact of methane gas, pipelines, and infrastructure?
Well, methane, you know, it's important to start with the fact that methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. So it is responsible for about a third of all warming to date, you know, since the Industrial Revolution. And it's not something that's widely appreciated. After carbon dioxide, methane is the next most important greenhouse gas. Methane, you know, it leaks anytime you drill a gas well, whether you're using conventional methods or fracking shales like the Marcellus Shale, which is, you know, the part of America that this book focuses on, it's going to leak. It's going to leak when you put it in a pipe and, it, you know, from various valves and compressor stations all the way to the end of the pipe, which, you know, may eventually end in your kitchen. On your gas stove or the furnace in your basement. Along the way, a certain amount of it leaks to the atmosphere. How much of it leaks is a very important number to know. And over the last several years, studies have shown that much more methane leaks from natural gas infrastructure in the U.S. than was previously thought, and certainly more than the government estimates suggest. And that's a problem because, at least, you know, in the context of climate change, to set aside other safety and health concerns around gas pollution, if a certain amount of it leaks, because it is such a potent warming agent in the atmosphere, it would cancel out any benefits from using coal to generate electricity versus natural gas. And so the bridge fuel idea, this is, you know, this goes back to the 1980s. The gas industry saw an opportunity as climate change burst into public consciousness in the wake of Jim Hansen's testimony to Congress. And they said, hey, our product could be a bridge fuel. They used those words in 1988, the American Gas Association, to a lower carbon, climate safe future. Well, that was 36 years ago. And we're still on the bridge. We're still building a lot of this gas infrastructure. And so the impacts on climate, local communities, health, safety, local economies, they've never really gotten the scrutiny that they deserve. And you could say in a way, like the bridge has never really been inspected closely, but we're still very much stuck on that bridge that the industry has built.
And you mentioned the environmental impact, of course, the climate impact, which we'll get back to. But I want to just ask you also about the health impact, because there has been a lot of controversy over gas stoves. You know, the fossil fuel lobby is ginning up a lot of hysteria over the Democrats and Joe Biden want to ban gas stoves. And yet gas stoves, which of course use methane gas, the evidence has been mounting recently that this is in fact quite dangerous to have gas stoves in one's home, to have gas furnaces.
That's right. And this, you know, this is a story that I followed pretty closely. I did some reporting on this in the last few years. And it's, you know, it's another impact from our reliance on gas that has been largely overlooked. And so here, just talking about gas stoves, the concern is that when you burn gas, especially in a kitchen that isn't ventilated. So if you don't have a vent hood going, or if your vent hood's not very good, or say you're a renter and you have one of those recirculating vent hoods that gets clogged with grease from all the cooking. So the pollution from burning gas, which can include particulate matter, but the main thing to be concerned about is nitrogen dioxide. That is a known respiratory irritant. We know that it can exacerbate or trigger asthma. And we've known this for a long time. And so, you know, way back in 1986, the EPA advised the federal regulators who kind of sign off on safety of consumer products, called the Consumer Product Safety Commission. EPA said, oh, you should really look into this, gas stoves and appliances. And that was in the mid-80s. And the industry has fought tooth and nail to prevent any kind of not just regulatory scrutiny or mandates or standards around gas stoves and appliances, but to sow doubt about the health impacts of being exposed to that pollution. And so you're right. In the last few years, there's been more attention on this issue as some independent analysts have looked at, gee, how many cases of childhood asthma in the U.S. could be attributed to this exposure? Because a lot of people have gas stoves, and a lot of people either don't have a good vent hood or they don't run it very often because it's loud and kind of annoying. And it's pretty striking, you know. One study found 13% of pediatric asthma could be attributed to gas stove use. And so this is just another part of the story that really has gotten inadequate scrutiny, both from, you know, the press and government regulators. And now that it's finally getting scrutiny, there's been a pretty telling reaction from the industry to this evidence.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jonathan Mingle about his new book, Gaslight, The Atlantic Coast Pipeline and the Fight for America's Energy Future. So this Atlantic Coast Pipeline, tell us about the company Dominion that planned to build this pipeline and its position in the states where it wanted to build and operate this pipeline.
Sure. So Dominion Energy is one of the nation's biggest energy companies. It's based in Richmond, Virginia. It owns the monopoly electricity utility in Virginia. So if you live in Virginia, chances are you pay your electric bill to Dominion. But for many years, Dominion was also heavily invested in gas assets. So like gas utilities around the country, gas storage, and increasingly pipelines. And so back in 2014, Dominion partnered with Duke Energy, which is another big energy utility giant next door in North Carolina, to develop the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. And this would have been a 600-mile long project, 42-inch diameter pipeline, probably it would have been the biggest to come out of Appalachia ever built. And it was going to come from the fracking fields of West Virginia through Virginia to bring gas to what Dominion and Duke said were really energy-hungry, gas-starved customers in coastal population centers of Virginia and North Carolina. So that was the rationale. Those two companies said, hey, we need more gas from this area. So more fracked gas from the Marcellus Shale in West Virginia, Western Pennsylvania, to keep the lights on, to lower your energy bills, and to kind of juice general economic prosperity. And so this project, you know, the story I tell in the book is how the people who lived along the route, especially in these rural counties in the western part of Virginia, is where I mostly focus the story. They were suddenly faced with this sales pitch. You know, this project is going to come through your land or your community or your county, and it'll be good for everyone. So you should get on board.
Now, why did they want to build this pipeline? I guess really what I'm asking for is talk a little bit about the economic benefit to these huge energy companies. Because the question can always be, you know, if they're in the business of selling energy, why don't they just move to renewables and do it that way? Why gas? Why pipelines?
So it's a great question. It's, you know, it's the question that hovers over, you know, the whole narrative in my book. And to answer it, you need to understand that gas pipelines are regulated by the federal government. So if you cross state lines, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has to sign off on it. And they almost always do. They approve over 99% of gas pipelines. They've never met a gas pipeline they didn't like. So in the wake of the fracking boom that came after the financial recession of 2008, 2009, there was just, you know, a flood of gas coming out of these shale plays, including the Marcellus Shale in Appalachia. And all that gas was looking for a way out, looking for new markets. And so companies like Dominion and Duke, which have a history as pretty staid, kind of boring utility companies, you know, they deliver gas or electricity. They own some power plants too, plenty of power plants. So, but they got into the pipeline developer business. Why? Well, it was kind of a gold rush. And there were lots of companies trying to build pipelines because you're guaranteed a 14% rate of return on your investment. It's a very low risk, high reward kind of investment, and Wall Street really liked it. Otherwise, they wouldn't have tried to build it. And then on the other end of it, so, you know, if you build a pipeline, you're kind of the toll keeper, you're the middleman, and people pay you to transport the gas. At the other end, the customers, 80% of the gas in the pipe they wanted to build would have gone to their own subsidiary power utilities. So Duke and Dominion were both the developers and owners of this pipeline and the primary customers. So they claimed they needed this gas to supply gas power plants that either they were already building or future ones they wanted to build. And then just the last piece of this, and you know, this gets in the weeds a little bit, but it's important. You know, at the state level, these companies are regulated by state public utility commissions. And those are, you know, anywhere from 3 to 5 people who sign off on whatever plans they have for what they want to build and charge their ratepayers. And building a gas power plant, you know, to get back to your question of why not embrace renewables, if you're a utility, you get paid based on your capital expenses. And so building a gas power plant is going to make you a lot more money. You get an 8, 9, or 10% return guaranteed, because that's the deal we've made with these utilities. We give you a monopoly to supply electricity. You get to, you know, argue for a certain rate of return that covers your costs and generates a premium for your investors. And these companies are owned and traded on Wall Street. It's a very lucrative undertaking to build a gas, you know, a methane gas power plant instead of a solar or wind farm or a battery storage project. You're just going to make less money building those things. Those other alternatives happen to be lower carbon, lower cost for their customers, but it just runs counter to their incentive structure. These companies are incentivized to build more methane gas infrastructure.
Yes, and they're also always, at least in New York State, where they've been fighting all the legislation to actually implement the New York State Climate Act. They are telling customers, and in fact, they have an AstroTurf organization called New Yorkers for Affordable Energy. They keep on saying that gas is affordable and reliable. That is their claim. But in reality, the pipeline that you speak about in this book, the notion was to, they were producing too much gas, and the threat was that the price of gas was actually going to go lower for them in reality. So they were very intent on exporting natural gas, which keeps prices high. I think a lot of people don't realize that gas prices are going up quite considerably and are likely to go up even more in the future. Not really affordable.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you hear these words over and over in news stories, advertisements, next to the words natural gas, affordable, clean, reliable, bridge fuel. And it's no accident that these associations get made. I mean, the industry has invested carefully and heavily in public relations campaigns to fix this idea that, well, the only way to really keep the lights on, because solar and wind, you know, they're intermittent, sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow, you got to have more gas to back up renewables coming onto the grid. So they've been very successful at cementing this narrative, certainly among political leaders, but even, you know, more broadly, in we talked about this earlier, like a lot of people have positive associations with natural gas, but not with fossil gas or methane or fracked gas, as we mentioned. And so, you know, in the book, I tell the story of how, you know, a particular coalition of people in Virginia fought this one pipeline and relentlessly, tenaciously for 6 years until they won, which never really happens. But in order to tell that story, you know, I kind of had to back up and tell the larger story of, you know, what brought this into their lives in the first place. And you really have to get into this very effective public relations campaign that the industry has waged for decades. And then that takes you into, yeah, exactly what you were talking about. There was all this gas flooding out of these shale formations once the fracking firms really took off. And you know, it was kind of like the tail wagging the dog. That gas needed more markets. It needed more customers. And the electric utilities became important customers, but they also, you know, they're also responsible for the fact that we're now, the U.S. is the world's biggest exporter of natural gas. We have all these liquefied natural gas terminals still being built on the Gulf Coast and elsewhere. And Dominion Energy, the company that tried to build this pipeline at the heart of my book, they built the second LNG export facility in the U.S. back in, while they were trying to build this pipeline. So they're very much at the heart of this gas building boom story that we're still in the middle of. So even though, you know, they never got to build their pipeline, there are plenty of other companies like Dominion that are still very aggressively pushing natural gas as a quote unquote climate solution. And so part of what I wanted to do in the book was to pull back the veil on how they go about misleading people.
And with a very appropriate title, Gaslight, which is exactly what they're doing. And so let's talk more about the story. You've referred to this coalition, this diverse coalition, actually, of grassroots activists. This is the first case, in fact, of a grassroots coalition stopping a large interstate frack gas pipeline. There were folks who spanned the political spectrum, all different kinds of backgrounds. First of all, what were some of the main fears that citizens had about the pipeline?
There were many different concerns that people brought to this fight. And for a lot of folks, I think it began with concerns about water quality. So during construction of the pipeline, you know, out in these parts of Virginia, it's very rural. Everybody's on a well. You know, water quality is front of mind for a lot of people. And for parts of this region, they sit atop karst, which is porous limestone. So there are these underground caverns and sinkholes, and water just flows through it. It's all connected to their drinking water aquifers and sources. And so a lot of people were concerned about the potential for contamination and risks to their water. People were worried about safety living inside the industry calls the blast radius, if there's a leak or rupture. And that happens with these pipelines. Recently in West Virginia, there have been a few of these explosions. And then a lot of people were really concerned about the use of eminent domain. So many people were brought into this coalition of groups that fought the Atlantic Coast Pipeline because they felt like the eminent domain power was being abused by a for-profit corporation to build something that wasn't going to benefit them and that wasn't really in the public interest. So those were some of the concerns. And some people were concerned about building a fossil fuel project that could operate for 80 years or more, as some pipelines still do now. And they were concerned about the climate impacts. So, you know, what was interesting is people came with different motivations. They came from different walks of life. And they, in the course of the story that I tell, one of the things that struck me most as I kept reporting and talking to different people was, you know, initially I was struck by their tenacity because, you know, I began reporting on this. They had already been fighting it for 5 years, but people didn't show any signs of slowing down. They seemed as determined to keep fighting it as ever. So that was striking to me. But then, you know, what became even more fascinating was to see how people were finding common cause across political, class, and racial divides in this part of Virginia, because they felt like it wasn't good for their communities, this project. And they also eventually, you know, some of them had their horizons expanded a little bit just by coming into contact with their neighbors who had different reasons for fighting the project. And it was interesting to see how some people's thinking about energy politics evolved, you know. And I had people who said, look, I'm a conservative leaning person. And, you know, I would be the type of person who, when they started protesting the Keystone XL pipeline out in Nebraska years ago, or Standing Rock, the Dakota Access Pipeline, I would have said, you know, what are they making all that fuss about? Think of all the jobs those projects will create. But these same people said, now that I've seen this process up close, the tactics the companies use and the sales pitch that they use to paper over all of the risks and costs and impacts, both environmental and economic impacts, they're, you know, they tell me, I'm now much more sympathetic to those people because, you know, when you see it up close, the case for it just falls apart, doesn't bear up under scrutiny, is how they described it to me.
Yeah. So give us an example. John Ed Purvis, he was one of those conservatives who got involved. How did his thinking evolve?
Yeah. And so John Ed Purvis, his family has lived on their land in Nelson County, Virginia, so at the foot of the Blue Ridge Mountains, since 1768. And his daughter and grandchildren live a mile away. He passed away several years ago. He's no longer with us. But, you know, I spent time talking to his family about his concerns and their concerns earlier in the pipeline fight. They were folks who, you know, Dominion Energy might have thought, you know, who are the types of people who will welcome this project? The Purvises might have fit that bill, as they acknowledged to me. But again, once they had to deal with this project coming through their land and started scrutinizing it, both the reasons Dominion put forward for why it wanted to build it, but also the process through which they interacted with local landowners, they got pretty disillusioned and wound up becoming much more sympathetic to folks fighting the Mountain Valley Pipeline, which is another project being built through similar terrain in Virginia, still under construction, almost finished. And it, you know, as one of his daughters put it to me, Martha, she said, you know, she said, I came to think of the pipeline like a bad person. You know how some people, you know, the more time you spend with them, you like them less and less. She's like, it was like that. They were love bombing us about like jobs and property taxes for the county in the beginning. But over time, those promises kind of evaporated and they were just left facing potential damage to their land, you know, their farmers. And so that, you know, that became a story I heard from other folks too.
Yeah. You mentioned the Mountain Valley Pipeline. Did this fight against the Atlantic Coast Pipeline inspire some of the work around that? Of course, the fighting on that has been going on for a long time and was on the verge of winning. The grassroots folks were on the verge of winning, and that got destroyed by Joe Manchin, and it was a deal between Joe Manchin and President Biden in order to get the Inflation Reduction Act passed. You know, just a terrible irony.
Yeah. So, I mean, these two pipelines are twins at birth. So the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and the Mountain Valley Pipeline, I think they were announced on the same day officially, and they were approved by the federal regulators on the same day in 2017. So I think the fight against the Mountain Valley Pipeline took place in parallel to the fight against the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. But because the MVP, the construction happened faster on that project, some of the landowners in that part of Virginia near Roanoke, they had to take stronger tactics, direct action kind of tactics, including sitting in trees. And they're still doing it. Many of these folks are still fighting it almost 10 years later, chaining themselves to excavators and trying to shut down construction, even though, as you pointed out, the pipeline was kind of rammed through by a last minute deal between Senator Joe Manchin and Democratic leadership in Congress and the White House it was to push through a debt ceiling deal. So totally unrelated piece of legislation. And the folks fighting the Mountain Valley Pipeline understandably felt betrayed because they had that project on the ropes. It was limping along and had lost a lot of federal permits. And so there are a lot of parallels with the story with the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. But, you know, that's the last chapter of my book. I kind of describe some of that, what happened there, just to show readers that, you know, this battle, the Davids beat Goliath with the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, but the larger war very much continues. And, you know, the Mountain Valley Pipeline is just one of many gas infrastructure projects that, you know, the rationale for them may or may not hold up under scrutiny, but the climate impacts are pretty clear, right? Like, these will add carbon and methane emissions to the atmosphere, and they'll do it for many decades to come.
And we are talking with Jonathan Mingle. His book is Gaslight, The Atlantic Coast Pipeline and the Fight for America's Energy Future. Stay tuned for more of our conversation right after the break.
Fracking is a form of natural gas drilling, an alternative to oil, because the oil kept spilling, bringing jobs to small towns, so everybody's willing. People turn on the lights and the drillers make a killing.
Water goes into the pipe into the ground. The pressure creates fission 7,000 feet down. The cracks release the gas that powers your town. That well's fracked, yeah, totally fracked.
But there's more in the water than just H2O. Toxic chemicals help to make the fluid flow. With names like benzene and formaldehyde, you better keep them far away from the water supply.
The drillers say the fishes are a mile below the groundwater pumped into American homes, but don't tell it to the residents of Sublette, Wyoming. That water's fracked. We're talking benzene.
What the frack is going on with all this fracking going on? I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think my water's on fire tonight.
That was the fracking song, My Water's on Fire Tonight, produced in 2011 by Studio 20 NYU in collaboration with ProPublica.org. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. Now let's get back to my conversation with Jonathan Mingle about his book, Gaslight. It's a story of how a diverse group of citizens came together to fight a pipeline proposed by one of America's biggest corporations, Dominion Energy, and won. So talk about how these folks won. They hired a law firm, the Southern Environmental. Now I don't have it right in front of me.
Yeah, the Southern Environmental Law Center. It's a nonprofit that works across the Southeast, and yeah, they're kind of a nonprofit law firm that works on protecting public lands and conservation issues. But they've become a leader in the region in pushing back against this methane gas build out. Yeah, they were instrumental to this story.
So the SELC, they undertook one of the tasks that they did was to say that this project, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, the ACP, should not be built because it was going through public land and specifically it was going through a national forest. And then there was another tack that the project should not be built because there was no economic need for it. Talk about these two strategies.
That's exactly right. So one of the things they realized very early on, and a gentleman named Greg Bupert was the lead lawyer working on this project. And so when he began in 2014 looking into it, He didn't know a lot about gas pipeline regulations and the particular laws like the 1938 Natural Gas Act that gives the federal government, this agency called FERC, the power to permit them if they are deemed to be in the public interest by those regulators. So he quickly had to kind of educate himself on the relevant statutes and regulations. And he quickly deduced with his colleagues that, you know, the odds were steeply stacked against them. I mean, these projects almost always get approved and almost always get built. And especially a project this scale, it was right in their wheelhouse. It was going through two different national forests in West Virginia and Virginia, through sensitive habitat, endangered species habitat. As I mentioned, areas that are vulnerable to water contamination. And it was going to go across the Shenandoah Valley. And then they would have to bore a mile-long hole through the Blue Ridge Mountains, under the Blue Ridge Parkway, under the Appalachian Trail, to emerge in Nelson County, Virginia, and then drill under the James River. So it was crossing iconic land features, parks, you know, protected lands, sensitive ecosystems. And those each required permits. So these projects needed permits from Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, Army Corps of Engineers for all the stream and river crossings. And what Greg Buport realized pretty quickly is that the key agency was this Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC. But FERC's track record wasn't very encouraging, because not only do they always say yes to these projects, FERC had this practice whereby if you become, you know, involved as an, it uses the term intervener, and anybody, you or I, anyone can become an intervener in that process and comment formally. If you challenge it in a court of law, FERC can just sit on it and wait it out. They use this strange bureaucratic term called tolling orders, which basically meant they could just, you know, ignore any legal request to reconsider the permit. And so Greg Buport and his colleagues were facing this reality, this bureaucratic kind of terrain that they knew meant, in practice, these projects, while you're waiting to get a hearing, if you're a citizen or an organization challenging it because you think it's risky environmentally, health-wise, economically not justified, these things will get built in the meantime. And so by the time you eventually get a hearing in court, they're already in the ground and they're already full of methane. So he wanted to avoid that. But in order to get that hearing on the fundamental question of, is this project in the public interest? And is the methodology that the federal regulators use to decide if it's in the public interest, does that methodology make sense? Are the economic benefits really what these companies claim they will be? And are they downplaying the risks and climate, environmental, economic costs and impacts on the other side of the ledger? So, like, that was the key question that these lawyers wanted to put before federal judges. But in order to get a chance to do that, they had to find a way to slow the project down. And so in one of the chapters of the book, I detail how they went about doing that. And it was, you know, it's hard in, you know, courtroom oral arguments and like leafing through massive documents, hard to wring a sense of drama and suspense out of that, but I tried my best. But what they did, you know, they used this metaphor internally of, we're jumping from rooftop to rooftop, and if we miss one, this pipeline gets built. So they felt like they were under a lot of pressure to, you know, this is 2018, to challenge these permits from the Forest Service to cross through the National Forest or the National Park Service to cross the Blue Ridge Parkway, they challenged them on the merits. They thought those permits were improperly issued. And eventually federal judges agreed with them and tossed them out. And that became how, with the support of their grassroots clients who were very involved in all of these legal challenges, they slowed the project down. They got construction halted so they could try to get that larger question. And that larger question that's at the heart of my book, is this massive, long-lived gas infrastructure, do we need it? Is it in the public interest, or is it a dangerous detour on the energy transition that we need to accelerate?
So talk about that strategy. I mean, what was the key that won the day in this battle? And how can that be extended or applied to all the other kinds of battles that we are facing as the window is closing on us being able to stop runaway climate change from taking over, in which case, you know, it's kind of game over. Now, I mean, I want people to be clear. I'm not saying that we are doomed, but we have a ever shortening window of opportunity here. How does this fight inform the fights that need to go forward?
Well, I mean, that is exactly what drew me to this story. I mean, on the one hand, coming into it, I knew there was a lot of confusion out there around natural gas. And just the fact that people don't know, you know, it's methane, it has climate impacts that aren't talked about enough. But the other reason I thought this story was worthy of a book and getting a wider hearing was that this is a very rare case of, you know, the little guys won against the big energy company. And everyone told them they were wasting their time early on, right? Everyone said, this is inevitable. You're going up against Dominion Energy, by far the most politically powerful corporation in Virginia and one of our nation's biggest energy companies. If they want to do something, it's going to happen. And so people heard that over and over again, but they kept fighting anyway. And what they found was that they had more agency than they realized, right? Turns out not everything is inevitable here. That pipeline didn't get built. And now Dominion is building, instead of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, they're building the largest offshore wind farm in America off the Atlantic Coast. I don't know if that would have happened if these folks hadn't relentlessly opposed this project and basically forced this company onto a cleaner energy path. So I think one of the key lessons from the story that I think is of much wider relevance, it's not a novel insight by any stretch. It's like, it's a very ancient insight, but I think it's worth the reminder in this moment. As you pointed out, we're in a critical moment, a closing window to get onto a cleaner energy path to preserve a chance at a livable climate. And the lesson is that we're stronger together, right? Like, so these folks discovered that early on, they felt very isolated, like John Ed Purvis, and overwhelmed because they felt isolated. But as soon as they started talking to each other, sharing information, kind of bucking each other up and gaining energy from each other, it put wind in their collective sails, and lo and behold, they won. And they had the help of some very smart, capable lawyers, and they had all kinds of other support. But I think that's the key takeaway here, is that folks have a lot more agency to change these outcomes than they realize, right? And then the corollary to that is, these market forces like solar, wind, batteries are getting cheaper by the day, which is fantastic news if you care about climate change. We need to build that stuff as fast as we can. But those market forces, you know, the march of technological progress itself is not going to win the day, because there are some very powerful entrenched interests who like the status quo. And the status quo is drenched in methane gas. It's a profitable thing to do, to build a new liquefied natural gas export terminal, or still, you know, maybe not on this scale pipeline, but pipelines are getting built today. And that means that people need to get up and get involved in the way these folks did fighting this pipeline. That's the bad news in a way, is that we can't just get on autopilot. But it's also the good news, because it's kind of more interesting and fun that way anyway. These folks, it was a difficult experience for a lot of them, but they also made lifelong friendships in the course of fighting this pipeline.
So what were some of the key factors in their win? What did they do that can help others do the same?
I think one key factor was, early on, they just started talking to each other, right? You get this letter, pipeline's coming, surveyors are coming. Everyone's confused, looking for information. And so there was kind of a spontaneous, organic quality to how some of these grassroots groups got organized early on. But they started pushing on every door they could. So talking to state legislators, local county officials, zoning boards of appeals. I mean, they did not pass up any opportunity to throw a roadblock in the way of this pipeline project, partly because they weren't sure what was going to be the most effective tactic. But they very quickly learned which doors were going to be helpful and which weren't, right? And so people quickly discovered that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission always says yes to these things. And so they didn't waste too much of their time after the first year or two focusing on that. They've started focusing on, as I mentioned earlier, these permits that these projects need to have, and discovering how shoddy some of the permits were issued by these federal agencies. So, you know, those tactics could be used to stop any kind of project, right? Whether it's a clean energy project or it's a fossil fuel project, you know, and there's this discourse today around quote unquote permitting reform. And it's undoubtedly true. We need to make it easier to build clean energy infrastructure. But the danger is that in doing that, there's a political bargain that gets struck that makes it easier to build more fossil gas infrastructure too. And that is a risk that I think doesn't get talked about enough. And so, you know, I could see how from the outside, some people would look at the story of what happened with the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and say, oh, was this a case of NIMBYs, you know, not in my backyard types, who just didn't want anything to come through their community? And I think that would not be an accurate characterization of what happened in this case. The people who fought it longest and hardest were people who weren't directly threatened by it. They just felt it didn't belong in anyone's backyard, that it wasn't in the public interest. And so if there's, you know, one thing that I think is relevant to the fights that are going on now and fights to come is, you know, they had this very clear sense, some of these grassroots groups early on, that we can't just foist this off onto some other community. We need to try to stop it. And even if we don't think we can do that, we'll be better off for having tried. And so that sense of like, okay, you want to use eminent domain, you want to claim that this project is going to benefit everyone, prove it. And if the regulators aren't going to hold you accountable to that, then we'll do their job for them. So that was the kind of spirit, the ethos that these folks took on. And it's not easy. And it was, people left careers and had health scares, and it upended their lives. But I think they would all, you know, the people I talked to for the book, they all speak to the lasting, I don't know, I'm searching for the right word. Simultaneously, they wouldn't wish this experience on anyone else, but like, they found a kind of deep joy and sense of purpose in fighting this project too.
Well, it's a great story, and it's a wonderful book, Gaslight, The Atlantic Coast Pipeline, and the Fight for America's Energy Future. Jonathan Mengel, it has just been great to talk with you about this book.
Francesca, thank you so much for having me, and I'm really grateful for the chance to talk about how I spent the last 5 years of my life.
Jonathan Mengel. Read an excerpt from Gaslight by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.